Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Marjorie Taylor Greene is moving to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson as lawmakers debate defense funding levels, police nationwide crack down on increasingly unruly campus protests, Donald Trump lays out his second-term priorities, National Intelligence Director Avril Haines highlights the threat from Russia and China as Beijing and Russia practice drills near Taiwan. French President Emmanuel Macron doubles down on why Europe needs to do more for its own security and that it's imperative to consider putting troops in Ukraine. As Kyiv continues to lose ground to a relentless Russian assault, and neither Israel nor Hamas have accepted a proposed ceasefire as Israel prepares its Rafah assault, and sadly, settlers depopulate large chunks of the West Bank. Joining us today, as they do each week, to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Hurston, the President of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, now with the Center for a New American Security, and the co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the Transatlantic Alliance. And welcome back to Washington. Jim, you're no longer frigid in Paris and dealing with protests, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. Before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Michael, start us off as you do every week. We'll get to the Taylor Greene motion to vacate in a moment, but let's start with where we are on defense spending levels and appropriations. The comptroller's office at DOD put out the Green Book, which some people have defined as a mess, and some questions about inflation assumptions and whether or not they're going to bite us. Walk us through where we are on the defense numbers debate, both for the National Defense Authorization Act on the authorization side of the equation, as well as appropriations. I thought it was great that in the, you know, sort of threat hearing, Jack Chairman Reed, you know, was running the hearing, passes it off to Angus King, if I recall correctly, so that he could go to an appropriations hearing. Anyway, but walk us through where we are now and where we're going.
So, look, the process is well underway, and I think we'll start with the House because their calendar shows that they're going to have a lot of action this month. We would expect to see the chairman's mark released on May 13th for the House National Defense Authorization Act with full committee markup on the 22nd and then House floor action on the week of June 10th. For the first time, there will be no subcommittee markups this year. They're going straight to full committee. Now, there is a vacancy on the House Armed Services Committee because of Mike Gallagher's resignation. So the House Republican leadership is going to try and get that seat filled prior to the markup. So they have the extra vote in there when difficult amendments come up. There are three people being mentioned. It's really down to two. Clay Higgins from Louisiana took best interest, but then withdrew. G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania, who currently chairs the Agriculture Committee, is interested. And Congressman Derek Van Orten from Wisconsin has expressed interest. And I would put my money right now on Van Orten. So, look, Rogers has said, as we've talked about this before, how he wants to mark to a higher number. He feels the budget's too low to meet the heightened threats. However, he came out this week and said that the NDAA will adhere to the spending caps. So NDAA will not mark to a higher number. Now, last week, we also talked about how the appropriators in the Senate are talking to marking to a higher number. Now, the Democrats in the Senate and the House are also now coming out and saying, look, starting with Patty Murray, who chairs appropriations, the Democrats will insist on a boost for non-defense programs that equal any potential defense hike that the Republicans insist on. And Rosa DeLauro, who's the senior Democrat on appropriations in the House, agreed, saying that any hike higher than the 1% for the Pentagon must be matched with equal increases for a non-defense program. So I've said all along, I still believe this. I do not believe that we're going to end up with higher numbers for defense. Now, McConnell said something interesting on this, too. McConnell attacked Biden's defense budget, saying that, you know, it's out of step with the administration's aim to compete with Russia and China amid the growing interconnected threats from North Korea and Iran, and that he'd hoped that the chaos in the world would have led our friends on the other side of the aisle to see the value in addressing these growing threats to our national security. But the president's budget request suggests otherwise, and he complains it doesn't keep pace with inflation. I got to say, I really think that's a very unfair attack from McConnell, It's not the president's fault. If anything, it's the Republicans' fault, because we are dealing with a statute called the Fiscal Responsibility Act, which by law limits institutes budget caps across the board and limits defense spending to 1% growth. So I think it's unfair to lay this at the president's feet. I'd say it's really more House Republicans that put us in this position than the Democrats have. So I think this noise is going to continue through the end of the year. And as I've said before, debt ceiling is going to be raised again in January. So I think this mess will not be over when the FRA expires, but will continue into the next Congress.
Dov, let me quickly bring you in on this, on where you think this is going to end up. And your former office, the DOD comptroller every year puts out the Green Book. I think they put it out on the 29th this year, which goes through, you know, it's very exhaustive in each of the services and breakdowns on, you know, what spending was, where we are, where it is, where we're going. Some people have sort of categorized it as a bit of a mess, but maybe not of the department's own making necessarily. But you know, walk us through where you think this is all going, and whether or not we're being as honest as we need to be about inflation assessments, even though employment, you know, the new job creation is down, even though the Fed decided not to cut interest rates, right? They're looking for a drop in employment that would then in turn, right, show a cooling of the economy, and then they can cut rates. Anyway, walk us through.
Well, first of all, the Green Book is essentially a statistical backup to the budget, and it will take you all the way back to budgets, and as I recall, as far back as the 1950s, maybe even before then. So you get a real sense of where defense has been and is going to be. You also get the consumer price index. You get all kinds of figures. The problem is not of DOD's making. I mean, the book is simply a reflection of what are the assumptions that the administration has had in certain areas, and one of them is about inflation. Now, the administration's inflation numbers are roughly just over 2%. Inflation, of course, is running approximately 50% higher than that. Now, defense inflation is always higher than the consumer price index anyway. So what you've got is not just no growth, but as Senator McConnell keeps saying, a real decline. And it just makes no sense. Given what's going on in East Asia and in Europe and in the Middle East. Remember, this administration wanted to pull out of the Middle East. Well, they're not pulling out at all, far from it. And who knows what will happen on Israel's northern border and how that might affect us, because we have ships in the Mediterranean and so on. So the inflation numbers are clearly not accurate, and that may be why some people characterize this as a mess. One other thing, I will take issue with absolving Biden from all of this and blaming the Republicans, simply because it's Biden that puts the budget together. And he could have come in with a higher number and then essentially challenged Congress to change the law, which it could do. And, you know, I mean, Congress could change Social Security laws for that matter. But he didn't do that. He chose instead to have a decline in defense. And if you don't think that Putin and Xi and the Iranians and the North Koreans aren't noticing that, you're living in a different world.
Well, but in fairness, I mean, I think we all know Joe Biden now pretty well. He's coloring within the lines as they were set. Hey, we made a deal. This is the number. I'm going to give you a budget at the number.
Well, you know why that doesn't hold? Because things have happened in the world. You could make a deal, and given what's happening in Ukraine, for example, where now it looks like the Ukrainians are really up against the wall, it just seems to me that he has every reason, or had every reason, to say, yeah, the circumstances were different when we cut the deal, but they are not the same now, and we must make a change. He could have done that. He didn't do it.
Dove, I agree. But I think, you know, part of this is, you know, everybody is out playing pure naked politics with this, and it's unfortunate, and there should be a consensus, and we should back it, and we shouldn't make stupid deals we have no intention of following. I mean, you know, alas, here we sit without opposable thumbs, as Gary Larson would say.
I agree. I agree with Vago. I mean, he is holding up to the deal that he made, that the Republicans actually tried to go back on to cut even further from. But it does not prevent Biden from submitting a supplemental request later this year to address the threats.
I think you should do that. I think we're being unrealistic about everything. I think that everybody on this program, and I think that many of our listeners also accept. Just to move on very briefly, Michael, you've explained this before, but some of the people in the audience are saying, wait a minute, straight to committee with kind of a brake screeching sound. Why is it going straight to committee?
I think it's just expedites the process. I mean, look, they really, I mean, the subcommittee markups are pretty much pro forma. Not a lot happens in those. They move very quickly. So I just think to save time, they're going straight to full committee markup. Nothing's really going to change that much as far as the process goes. Everyone will still have a voice and a chance to amend the bill. But very few amendments are addressed in the subcommittee markup. They're mostly addressed in the full committee.
Let's go, just speaking of briefly, let's go to MTG's moving to oust the speaker. Democrats have said they will protect the speaker. But the question some people are asking is, okay, how many times do they need to protect the speaker? And it's not going to work. Republicans are worried about political damage. I think the Democrats are subjected, and certainly the president, to more political damage by the campus protests. And we'll discuss that later in the program. But just really quickly, how is this going to play out? Because neither the speaker nor anybody else is worked up about this, aside from a small number of people at this point.
Yeah, no, exactly. A lot of this is theater, right? Remember, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed her motion to vacate back on March 22nd, but didn't make it privileged, so it didn't go anywhere. On April 16th, you know, many weeks later, she said that Johnson's speakership was over and he should resign or face a vote. And that was after he had announced that he was going forward with the emergency supplemental package, which included aid to Ukraine. The package passed on April 20th, and she didn't do anything. And there was a feeling that, you know, she was just going to hang it over her head. She loved the negative attention. And wasn't going to make a move. However, on Tuesday this week, Democratic leadership released a statement publicly saying that they would vote to table any GOP effort to oust Speaker Johnson, and that if she does invoke the motion, it will not succeed. And this was a very, I think, smart move on behalf of Democratic leadership. This was Hakeem Jeffries, Catherine Clark, and Pete Aguilar locking arms on this. And even though they met with their conference, they had this statement ready to go before they even heard from their conference. And as a result, Marjorie Taylor Greene took the bait. And right afterwards, she then, after the statement came out, she signaled that she would go ahead with a vote on this. Americans deserve to see the uniparty on full display, she said. So she wants recorded votes. And this is despite the fact that people in Trump world are telling her to stand down. I mean, Michael Whatley, right, who's the new Trump installed RNC chair, said to her, you know, don't go ahead with this. But she held a press conference on Wednesday saying that she would trigger the motion to vacate next week. She said she wants to give Johnson the weekend to think about resigning, which is total nonsense, right? She wants the weekend to continue to raise money off of this, and she wants that negative attention next week when she comes back on Monday, all the cameras and lights on her. When is she going to do it? She'll probably, she said she's going to do it next week. She might do it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. She will do it. The motion to the table will succeed, and we will move past this. But you're right. She could do it again. And will the Democrats continue to stand by Johnson as this goes forward? That remains to be seen. Will they extract concessions from him later on? That remains to be seen. And I think the closer we get to election, it becomes in the Democrats' interest to see the chaos in the House, because nothing's really going to pass after FAA reauthorization gets done. So that ends up heavily helping the Democrats if that continues.
Well, it's good that at least FAA reauthorization, I know a lot of people will be cheering that. Let's quickly go around the horn. Former President Trump gave two wide ranging interviews to Time magazine, and it was a great story. Trump plans a more radical second term. I think we knew that. I just want to quickly go around the horn on whether anything is tremendously different or just confirms all of the suspicions we had, because he said things in there that are potentially politically problematic. Anyway, whoever wants to start, and then let's cycle through the whole team. Here, Dove, why don't you start us off, Jim, Patrick, and then Michael.
Well, he didn't really say anything new. What he basically did was do it all in one, essentially one interview. He's got some things that I think are not, could not happen, even if he were president, using the National Guard, using the military, and forgetting about Posse Comitatus. He seems to have waved that one away. Posse Comitatus, of course, means you can't use the military for civilian activities or civilian operations. But basically, he simply confirmed, and essentially was aiming at his base, confirmed what people have been saying all along. I didn't detect anything new or shocking, because at this point, nothing he says particularly shocks me anymore.
Jim?
Well, you know, it's interesting that Dove is absolutely right. There was nothing new there. And to me, that's a major flaw in all of this. In other words, the stuff he was saying wasn't new. Not only was it not new, it was dated from years back. So this guy is coming to the fore, not only with stuff that's dated, we've all heard before, but without a fresh thought in his mind. I mean, that's really assuming he has a mind. I mean, I don't want to say that, but I mean, this is it just shows how vacant he is. He calls it in, you know, he just sat there and BS'd in the interview, saying the old stuff that he'd say at the corner bar with a beer in his hand. And then it was over, showing such a lack of any intelligence between those two ears of his. And I'll just leave it there.
Well, that said, he is polling well. And later in the program, we'll discuss about how some factors are actually hurting, right? It seems like almost everything ends up hurting Biden, and virtually none of it actually sticks to him, including some of the language that he's talking. I mean, it to be, you know, and sadly, 75% of Republicans apparently now think, or 74% think it's okay to be an authoritarian, in order to help tackle the nation's problems, even if, you know, it's sort of somehow limited to one day, but then it would be the definition of how long a day is. Patrick, your sense on whether you picked up anything interesting in that jumped out?
Well, sycophancy is not a recipe for good strategy, and you could, you know, but what I worry about from some of that interview is what a Trump administration might do to further politicize the civil service and to create a new schedule that basically makes a bigger layer of political appointees that are all loyalists to the White House. I think that would be a big step against the checks and balances system that we have. And I do worry about that having lasting damage if he were able to do that.
I would agree with you on that. And again, it suggests also politicization of the military by putting the military into doing things that is not really the role of the military to do, certainly from a domestic context. Michael, you're a pretty savvy political watcher. You know, did you spot anything that, you know, made you go,
No, not really. I think everybody is correct. I mean, there's a lot of the same old stuff about deporting migrants and using the military domestically. The one thing that was new, that I think it was new, was he said that he would disband the White House Office on Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy, which, you know, because Biden established it, he's got to get rid of it. And I guess he assumes the odds are in his favor. There will not be another pandemic during his next 4 years if he gets them. But at the end, you know, as crazy as all this is, one, I think, you know, the timing is good in the sense that we do see a lot of unrest in some of our college campuses, which I think plays to his wanting to use the National Guard. But also it shows again that Biden has yet to lay out his vision for what his 4 years are going to look like. We know what Trump's are going to look like, right? What are Biden's 4 years going to look like? And he needs to lay that out sooner rather than later.
Well, the White House would argue he has done it. It's just that it's hard for the president's message to penetrate, right? So even in news stories, in the wake of the president's, you know, very brief address yesterday, in the wake of the campus protests, you know, I thought was very sensitive, sensible, very middle of the road. There was nothing to quibble with. Said he didn't believe the National Guard should be sent in. What I thought was interesting in all of the news stories was all the fervor, the over-the-top fervor. And then at the end of the day, the president addressed it yesterday briefly in remarks at the White House, right? Like saying free speech. And it's interesting that actually Biden more often than not ends up getting buried. In at least I think that's a frustration that some people in the White House would say, would see events going that way. Jim and Patrick, Director Haynes and the new director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Air Force Lieutenant General Jeff Cruz, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee on threats facing the nation. A lot of focus on Russia, as well as on China, some sort of naked political questions being asked of intelligence people who I think, as a general rule, try to play it pretty straight and be like, look, this our job is to generate the intelligence. It's for other people to interpret the intelligence and what to do about it. You know, Patrick, you know, China loomed large and there was a lot of discussion about it, including, you know, concerns about Chinese fingers in what is happening domestically, as well as Russia. And Jim, I want to get your sense next. Patrick, take us away on what you thought was interesting about what Director Haynes had to say and General Cruz.
Well, and we're just hearing the public version of this. It'd be interesting to hear what they said behind closed doors. But the top line issues for me were that Russia has become a concerted foe of the United States across the board, and that Russia and China are increasingly cooperating, and that has huge implications for us, you know, from Ukraine to Taiwan. The fact that Russia is now spending 7% of its GDP on defense is, you know, should worry the Russian people, but I don't think it does. Unfortunately, it's emboldening Putin to say that, yeah, China is going to prop up my economy, and these spare components for my defense industry are exactly what I need to keep in this war. And then running these joint combat readiness patrols near Taiwan. This is a first, said Avril Haines, and that's very worrisome, because even though they're not a joint and combined operation, they are coordinating increasingly, and that's what the DIA director said, that we have to really be worried that the defense requirements that we've assumed for Taiwan contingencies and other contingencies in Asia are inadequate. So those are worrisome trends that you know, should be lighting a fire under Congress and Washington on these things. And meanwhile, Russia's out to get us everywhere. And we don't have time to talk about what's happening in Niger, in Africa. But the fact is that we have been booted out of Niger, in effect, and the Wagner group is in, you know, right. the new Wagner group. And, you know, Russia's dirty hands are all over this operation.
I would also point out that unfortunately, France, which has really been our essential partner in Africa, it too has found itself on the back foot across many of its former colonies and places where it would have curry and sway, that also unfortunately have been sort of supplanted in some cases by Russia. Jim, your sense on what sort of jumped out at you from what she had to say, because the conversation did center on Russia and Ukraine. Obviously, the behind-the-scenes conversation would be more interesting, but we're not going to be privy to that. What's your sense on what jumped out at you before, you know, I get your take on the war and where we are?
Well, I guess what jumped out is something that we just discussed a few minutes ago about the defense budget. I mean, the intel folks that were talking, you know, they supply this intel that is not necessarily something new publicly, at least, you know, we've heard a lot of this. And they are the ones that supply this up the chain to the administration, to the president. And yet the defense budget it hasn't gone up in a way that recognizes the problems that we're facing right now. You know, it kind of concerns me that it's really Macron that's ringing the alarm bell, and he's doing it for Europe. But I don't get the same sense here, whether it's reflections in the defense budget or other things, that this intel that we're hearing, that we know, that publicly we know the bits of it, hasn't spurred the administration to say something about that. And that goes to something that Michael just said in terms of the Biden administration's response. You know, what are they saying about the next 4 years? And I raise that now because, you know, I just was criticizing Trump for not saying anything new, but, you know, Biden isn't either. And as Michael said, and I agree, the Biden administration needs to say something new. And if they just roll out the same old bromides that we hear all the time from the president and his people, and particularly in the face of this intelligence, the face of the defense budget not going up, then I'm wondering, you know, what's this administration doing? You would expect to hear the engine rooms, you know, throbbing now with the engines going quicker in terms of defense or other things, but it's crickets as far as I'm concerned. So my takeaway was that it wasn't like I heard something really new. I'm just interesting that there seems to be a disconnect between what the intel people are saying and what the administration is doing.
I would agree that it's time for the team to more clearly sort of put together, as opposed to saying, look, here are all the things that we've done in the past. People really want to see, like, okay, we already have an age concern. You're an accomplished man. We got that. But what are you going to do next? And then concerns that, you know, he was too far to the left. His break to the middle has not been as pronounced or as quick. Let me take you to the war. And you mentioned Emmanuel Macron. I just have to urge our audience to read The Economist's story and the full transcript of the interview with Macron. It is a stunning interview. And I would really, if you're strategy minded, there is not a single thing in that interview that you should be quibbling about, because effectively he's making a very powerful case, again, as he did in his almost two hour speech at the last week at the Sorbonne. Two questions, Jim. The first question is, the Ukrainians have lost about 600 or more square kilometers of their territory. It was hard fought, collectively cost many lives, an enormous treasure, including from the United States and its allies and partners. The Russians, by delaying, the Russians have really gained an upper hand. And it's unclear whether or not we're going to be able to help them fast enough, right? So how dire is, would you characterize the situation right now? Because Macron's point in this essay, which is unfortunately getting a lot of negative attention in France, which it shouldn't, his point is, at some point we will have to consider this because the other guy has no red lines and we shouldn't impose red lines on ourselves. How dire is this situation? And how reasonable is what the French president is saying? You know, why it's important not to dismiss out of hand having to put troops there in case the Russians break through?
Well, I agree with you. There was, you can't read that transcript in The Economist and find something that is anti-US or anti-West, anti-NATO, this kind of thing that a lot of Washingtonians look for. A lot of what he says is absolutely true. He's speaking to a European audience there, trying to get everyone to get traction on rising to the occasion. And frankly, I think when I look at something dire, I'm more dire in terms of European efforts and progress, real progress, in getting ready for a situation where Ukraine might not be successful. And we've got an aggressive Russia on that we're having to deal with, and a deterrent that's not very credible. I think that's dire. I think as far as Ukraine and the battlefield there, it's a matter of holding the line and not lose any more in terms of their territory, and then see where we go. It's going to be a while before Ukraine will be able to have what it needs for an offensive. And during that time, I think Russia is going to be getting stronger and stronger. So I don't know what we're looking at there on the battlefield right now. It's going to be difficult to see until we're midway or towards the end of the summer, just how things are going there. But when I think about dire, my real concern is Europe. And if Europe realizes it is weak, what would their response be to a real challenge by Russia? Would they kind of fold their cards and go, look, we don't have the ability to push back on you? And do they kind of fold? And the last point, and I'll stop here. Last point is that U.S. leadership in the past has been what's pulled Europe together and had us do things. U.S. leadership from the very top in Europe isn't present right now. We're stretched thin in terms of leadership. We're focused on Gaza and the Middle East. We got the campaigns and things starting up. What is missing is U.S. leadership rallying everyone to really make faster progress. It's not there. It's Macron who's trying to do it. And the U.S. is sitting it out. And that makes the Europeans think the U.S. is out of the game. It's us facing the Russians by ourselves. Do we cut a deal? Or do you think we can really make progress and strengthen ourselves? I mean, I think as the months go by, that's going to be what they're thinking about, because the U.S. just isn't there rallying.
I would agree with that, right? As much as the United States has acted, I think. I would say the checking out has been relatively recent, right? I mean, we have been very focused, at least until around October 7. It was in the aftermath of that we have sort of gotten a little bit distracted. But Macron's whole point is the United States is really going to be focused on the China challenge. And so we're going to have to step up and do more. And then, of course, it depends on what happens in November, right? I mean, the United States, as you said, the United States has been bearing this burden, and it's time for us to step up and do our part in that. Just very, very briefly, do you think that, he's been ahead of the power curve on a lot of this stuff. I mean, he even boils it down to we're not generating the individual per capita income that we need to be creating right. in order to support the state, the generous social welfare states we've created, which is then also becoming an irritant, right? So he's like, we've got to grow on all axes to grow our way through this. I know that this is part of European elections. I know that the right wing is expected to do very well, which will then presage whether or not we have a right wing French president who's also an enemy of the EU, which would be a giant strategic change. Is anybody listening to this cry aside from Poland and the Baltics?
Yeah, I think certainly Central Europe is and that type of thing. But I think the problem in terms of who's listening is Macron has a problem in that he has said a lot of this kind of thing. He's right in what he's saying, but he has said it often, at least over the past year or so. But he's flipped from where he was 2 years ago, vis-a-vis Putin. So he's lost some credibility with a lot of leadership, particularly in Berlin and the UK. They're off doing their thing. But I think there are two problems. One is that he's lost credibility because he's among with a lot of listeners, because they just say, well, it's Macron. He's typical. He's exaggerating. He's and they'll just be dismissive. They're not listening. They're being dismissive. And the second thing is people will say, well, he wants France to be the leader. He wants France to say, follow me, and we're going to remake Europe and the French image and blah, blah, blah. So those two strikes, that it's Macron personally or it's the French agenda, that weakens people taking an interest in and listening to what he's saying. And my point is, for God's sake, listen to it now and take some action here in terms of Europe, because if they feel that they're too weak at the end of the day and they're not going to be able to deter, then I don't know what Europe will do. That they could just falter. And that's just what Putin is hoping will happen. And the U.S. could be absent.
Dove, as a longtime observer, your sense, I mean, I think Macron and the folks at the Élysée would say the president was trying to negotiate his way through this in the early parts of it, right, when he met with Putin and the like. And it was after that that the break happened. And then the question was all, mechanical internal stuff. But I agree with you. There was a shift. And it's a welcome shift. Dove, your sense on where we are, where we're going.
Look, Macron is right. And the implications are huge. There's, some of the folks have already mentioned the issue of defense spending. But it's not just defense spending. It's about our defense strategy. We continue to assert that the Russians are an immediate threat, an immediate problem, maybe medium term, but not long term like China. And I think what Macron is signaling is beyond the fact that Europe needs to do more, which nobody will disagree with, at least nobody on this side of the ocean, is the fact that Russia is a longer term threat. There's no question in my mind that, first of all, Putin's got five more years and probably six after that. 11 years to me is relatively longer term. And who knows who comes after Putin? I mean, this is classic Russian strategy since the 18th century. And so, of course, if we were to acknowledge that in our strategy, then people would say, well, why doesn't your budget reflect the strategy? So the whole thing is circular. In order to keep the budget down, our strategy doesn't change. And in order to assure that the strategy doesn't change, we keep our budget down. And the problem, of course, is the real world doesn't necessarily put together budgets and strategies the way we want them to be put together.
Speaking about budgets and strategies, Patrick, you mentioned how Russia And China are now conducting joint exercises off of Taiwan. You mentioned that Director Haines did discuss that. What are the implications of that, right? We in Washington have a tendency of thinking of Russia as a European land power, not as a Pacific power as well, that used to have a lot of ships out there and still has submarine capabilities and surface capabilities, has aircraft that are skirting, you know, American airspace up in Alaska and elsewhere. What's the right way for folks to be responding to this? And then I want to go to the international traffic in arms, the ITAR exemptions to speed collaboration between Australia, the United Kingdom, and U.S. On AUKUS. But start us off with how we need to be dealing with this problem, because this is also an Indo-Pacific problem.
It is. And on this day, as Admiral Porpero, you know, takes command of the Indo-Pacific Command later today, we're recording in the morning, there's a real possibility that deterrence will fail on his watch. So Admiral Aquilino can say on his 3-year watch it didn't, but will Admiral Porpero be in that same position come 2027? And I think that's the real concern here. Russia's lifted the lid on the risk of conflict ever since its direct invasion in 2022. The coordination between Russia and China is emboldening all these revisionist actors, including North Korea and Iran. And so there's a serious danger that China slips from this psychological game that it's playing mostly, this people's war, in effect, for hearts and minds, into kinetic action. I don't think that's what she wants still in these next 3 years, but increasingly it's a possibility for which we're not fully prepared. And that's notwithstanding all the many good moves that we've made on building up this lattice work of defense partnerships, including, frankly, Japan just opening up discussions with France on a reciprocal access agreement, just as they've started that with the Philippines, and just as Australia, the Philippines, Japan, and the United States met in Hawaii yesterday. At the defense minister's level to talk about the need for more exercises. So there are many good things going on with our alliance structure, but is it sufficient to maintain deterrence against a China that has a Russia backing and that is creating problems in Europe and Africa and elsewhere? And that is, you know, the big question, and we can't answer that. We have to do our very best to be ready and to be stronger and to be more united, and to keep investing as well in the cutting edge technology that's going to make a difference. The Chinese just reorganized again their strategic support force, which shows that, one, maybe it was a failure to try to integrate cyberspace and information warfare, or maybe they're really getting serious about intelligentized warfare and they're getting closer to it, and they recognize that that information part of it is so important, such a separate domain, that they will win the war that way. And that's something we've got to watch very closely.
And let me what about the AUKUS export control changes? Because that's really where cooperation either flourishes or dies. And I remember a senior British official had told me, if we get that right and we make this all seamless, that's going to send a more powerful message to the Chinese than even the technology that comes out of it, which will be very positive.
Yeah, this is a very interesting front. This is such a banal issue about rule changes on the international trafficking in arms regulations, ITAR, but it's seriously significant. In fact, it shows you also the bureaucracy that we have in place. I mean, Abe Denmark at the Defense Department tweeted out this week that this will remove more than 1,000 export permit requirements for the AUKUS partners, this AUKUS exemption that they're creating under this rule change proposal, which has until the end of May for comment, and then they'll hopefully act on it. Kurt Campbell's been in the UK this week talking to the Brits about AUKUS, presumably also preparing for potential change in government in Britain and making sure that doesn't disrupt AUKUS going forward. I know the Australian Submarine Agency, and if you didn't, you haven't been following the new bureaucracy. I mean, the 10-month-old Australian submarine agency will be coming to town next week. And I know I'm having meetings. And so there's a lot going on here on the AUKUS front that is extremely serious about the technology cooperation that is going to shift the military balance of power potentially in this region. And that is something that I'm sure the Chinese and the Russians are very much watching.
Indeed. And I still think it was great to have Japan now as part of it. And I do believe that we should bring France into that as well.
A footnote on that, Vago, is that, yes, not only has Japan been announced as, you know, as a likely member of the second
pillar defense, two.
Advanced capabilities, pillar two, but also Korea has now made it clear that it wants to be part of pillar two as well. And I think the administration is very much trying to work with both Tokyo and Seoul to make that happen.
What are the prospects of bringing France in? It is the only European Indo-Pacific power, and I think that it's imperative they be part of this as well. What are the prospects of doing
when you that? Think about what Japan has just done in terms of opening up this reciprocal access agreement arrangement with a Pacific power, France? You can see why, yes, France needs to be part of that as well. So I think we are now finally connecting the dots here, the UK and France, Australia, you know, Korea, Japan, U.S., and hopefully others.
We've got not a lot of time, but a lot more to discuss really quickly. Patrick, also want to get your sense on President Biden's comments. He was making a case for immigration and why America is different and the countries that don't have immigration can end up suffering. He mentioned China. He mentioned Russia. But he also mentioned Japan and India, however true those statements are, although there would be those who would argue that Japan is opening up, albeit maybe a little bit more slowly and a little bit later, because Japan has prided the homogeneity of culture that it's had indeed for a very long period of time. How badly do they hurt the president? This came up at the press conference yesterday, White House press conference, and it didn't get that many questions, although it did get a couple of questions. Anyway, what's your sense on how this is going to play in Delhi as well as Tokyo, which are two integral American partners that are more integral and important with each passing day?
What the president should have said and meant to say, undoubtedly, was that we are, you know, a proud nation of immigrants and that Japan is resistant to immigration reform and is 98% ethnic Japanese. But unfortunately, he said that they're xenophobic like the Chinese and the Russians. Terrible alliance management, terrible in terms of your own immigration policy. We, you know, right now to many Asian countries, the United States looks like we don't have sort of law and order. You know, we have campus protests, we have guns proliferating, and we have borders that seem to be open. So we have to get our own act together. And good immigration policy is what we need. And so what I would tell the president is that, you know, not all immigration is equal. If we have illegal immigration, that's not very smart. If we have smart legal immigration, that's great policy. Let's get that done. And let's not beat up on Japan. And by the way, you've just built one of the strongest sort of relationships with Japan in terms of this alliance. Look at your recent summit, more than 70 deliverables. So let's stick on the positive side and let's not drag them under the bus of problems that we don't need.
Indeed, very, very problematic. Dove, would like to get to this, and Michael, I'll come to you in a moment about campus protests and everybody can discuss it. But really quickly, walk us through where we are right now. The United States has is going to spend more than $300 million to build a pier to deliver aid to Gaza. Overland routes would be better, but Israel is not being maybe as open as it or rapid as it could be. So we're having to take this extraordinary step. The Rafah offensive remains on the table. BB is saying, I'm going to be unmoved. There's a peace deal between, or at least a ceasefire, that some hope would be permanent if it catches. But Hamas has been reluctant. Israel has its own points it wants to make in that context. And now the New York Times is reporting that Israel is considering maybe a power sharing arrangement with Arab states in Gaza. Meanwhile, you have the Haaretz story that shows that fairly nice chunks of the West Bank are being depopulated as Israel announced more housing units, right? I mean, there's a lot of activity going on as we get focused with protests and everything, right? I mean, these protests serve the interests of a lot of people, I would argue, whether China, Russia, Hamas, Israel, or anybody else. What's the next step here in this conflict, which the White House was hoping was going to be over. A lot of people, folks hoped it would be over. But if you're Bibi Netanyahu, who, like Viktor Orban, wants Donald Trump in office, it's kind of in your interest to stretch this out as long as possible to hurt Biden, even if Biden embraced you and is taking the heat for it. Bad friendship management, but alas, Joe Biden is loyal. Where is this going?
Well, first of all, the basic problem is that Hamas still does not want to release all the hostages. If they do
does
that,
does not want or cannot.
Well, that's a good question. But one wonders why they cannot. Why they cannot even provide a list of those that they do have. They have absolutely refused. So there's a real problem with Hamas, and I don't know how you solve it. On the Israeli side, obviously, when Netanyahu goes and says we're going into Rafah no matter what, that doesn't help. Also, there clearly could have been a corridor from the northern Gaza to southern Gaza, which would have eliminated a need for a pier to be built at a cost of God knows how much, 300 million probably will go up. The number will go up. The Israelis don't want to do that. So you have to look at all of that. And then you look at the protests. And I wrote about it in The Hill this morning. The protests are going to alienate people, just like they did in 68, by the way. And a lot of columnists have already pointed that out. But the flip side of that is what I just said about Netanyahu, which is he undermines the value that the protests would have otherwise given him, because people would be fed up with the not just the protesters, but with the Palestinian cause, which the protesters are hurting. So there's that. Now, in terms of what Haaretz says, there's no question that Smotrich, whose doubles as both finance minister and this kind of deputy defense minister, it's not clear exactly what the title is planning to legalize a whole bunch of illegal settlements. And he and Ben-Gvir, the other extremist, clearly would love to push the Palestinians out of the West Bank if they could. But since they can't, they'll at least build more and more settlements. Well, that too undermines the Israeli case. So you've got a situation here where, on the one hand, the Palestinian cause is being hurt by these crazy, violent, there's no other word to use, and anti-Semitic protesters. Many of them are anti-Semitic. When you turn around and say anybody who supports Israel is a Zionist, and by definition, a Zionist is somebody that we don't want to have anything to do with. I don't know if you know this, but the Justice for Palestine crowd refuses to use the word Israel. You can't use the word Israel at all. So you've got all of that, which alienates Americans. But then you have the Netanyahu government. Netanyahu refuses to get rid of these extremists because he wants to hang on. And quite possibly he wants to hang on because of Trump, although he hasn't spoken to Trump in 3.5 years, and Trump has criticized him. So who knows? But in the meantime, Gaza is a mess. People are being killed. And you've always got the problem on the northern border, where at any moment a war could break out there, and there are already 100,000 Israelis who've been displaced, which very few people talk about.
And Ben-Gvir, of course, the minister of national security. Look, it's just, you know, this has been a problem. It's been a problem for a long time. Not addressing the problem doesn't make it go away anymore quickly. Michael, I'm going to bring you back around because you've also got breaking news. But also first, want to get your sense on the campus protests and how they're playing politically. Dove is spot on the mark. Some of these protests have been peaceful. For example, on George Washington University, my alma mater, Josh Rogan of The Washington Post did a great visit to campus and wrote a great tweet about it. Right. There are multiple different ways of protesting. You can be violent or you could be not violent. Unfortunately, we've seen that the violence is off campus, folks. And in the case of UCLA, in that case, it was pro-Israel protesters that were involved in it. This is not a good situation. It's undermining, you know, folks' support, you know, just like Hamas damaged the Palestinian cause in many respects, the protests and the nature of the protests and the anti-Semitic flavor of some of them has been problematic. And this has become a political football. Now, I should also note There are young Jewish American kids and Jewish French kids who are participating in these protests, you know, because they are protesting Israel's actions in Gaza at the end of the day. How does this play at a time when the president needs every young person, needs every vote in Michigan? Where is this going ultimately, and the impact it's going to have?
Okay, well, let's back up. I know there are some Jewish kids participating in these protests, but they're useful idiots and very ignorant of their of the history and their own on their own background. They're being, you know, I think taken advantage of. The Sunday Girl letting themselves being taken advantage of. And you mentioned the GW protest as being, you know, nonviolent, but they're using a lot of violent language there. There are signs that say "Find a solution" on the GW campus. There are signs that say that the Jews need to go back home to their real home in Europe, which of course is not their real home. So I'm not going to make any excuses for the people on George Washington University's campus.
I am not making any excuses for anybody, right. But the question is, how is this affecting the dynamic, the political dynamic?
When people are
saying they're going to vote for a third party candidate, right? At the end of the day, that could hurt both parties.
This is much worse for Democrats than it is for Republicans, right?
Yeah.
You know, we saw earlier this week a lot of the pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested on several college campuses. There's been a lot of frustration within the Democratic caucus that they're not talking about anti-Semitism within the caucus. They're not taking a position. Their position's been very gray. So finally, President Biden on Thursday made his first real remarks on this, condemning the protests that have turned violent. He said there is a right to protest, but not a right to cause chaos, and destroying property is not peaceful protest, which was kind of an endorsement of the decisions that were made by Columbia and UCLA to all in the police to try and clear these kids out. But you mentioned GW, which should be noticed is George Washington University asked the DC police to come in and clear them out, right? Because they have taken over streets, like 8th Street is closed off because they have made an encampment on these streets. The mayor has refused to send the police to clear out those encampments. And that's going to have major political repercussions, which we'll talk about in a second. Also, these kids are not doing themselves any favors, you know, who barricade themselves inside buildings and then demand that the school bring them food and water, right? And they say it's, you know, it's basic humanitarian aid that they're asking for. They're making themselves.
It's ridiculous.
They're trying to act like they're the gods. It's a 7-Eleven two blocks away. Go get yourself something to eat. I mean, it's just utter nonsense. And now you have folks on the right saying, look, you can't denounce January 6th rioters and then say that Columbia students who occupied a building by force and destroyed property should be immune from the consequences.
Well, They're not being arrested on trespassing and even being expelled for violence. But it's not the same as taking over the Capitol when it's doing its business to certify an election.
This is all you're asking about the political implications here.
Correct.
This is the political narrative is turning against the Democrats on this, right?
As Trump makes the case that the world is in chaos and only I can save the world from this chaos.
Right.
From
but, walking against the Democrats again are not helping themselves on this. Look, the Republicans have found an issue that they can agree on, right? Which is countering this anti-Semitism on college campuses, right? And Johnson is leaning into this, right? He's announced a house-wide investigation into anti-Semitism on campuses. Next week, the House Oversight Committee is going to hold a hearing to probe why the DC police rebuffed GW's ask to bring in the police to clean up their campuses. If the Republicans get control of the House, Senate, White House, I think we'll see an end to home rule here in DC. Several Republican-run panels that said they're going to spend the appropriation season trying to strip federal funds from schools that don't do enough to protect Jewish students. We saw earlier this week the House passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act bill, which is going to power the Department of Education to crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses. The vote was overwhelming. It's 320-91, but 70 Democrats voted against it. This does not help their narrative. On top of that, a group of 57 Democrats led by Pramila Jayapal, the head of the anti-Semitic caucus, is calling on President Biden to withhold the transfer of certain offensive weaponry and other military support to Israel that can be used in a potential offensive against Rafah, right? That doesn't help them either. And what's concerning to me about that, not only is it 57 Democrats, most of them are far left wing, but you had two moderate Democrats on House Armed Services sign that letter. And that's Joe Courtney and Andy Kim. I personally think it was a mistake for them to sign it, but this is not a good thing. If you look at the polling on this, right, 80% of Americans are with Israel on this, right? And it goes across all age groups, including younger age groups where the polling is not as good, but 57% of the kids ages 18 to 24 favor Israel. And it only goes up from there. For people over 65, 93% of those people support Israel. And those people vote, the ones that are 65 and above. So this is not a good thing for Democrats going forward.
I would agree, and I'm not condoning violence by anybody, nor am I condoning anti-Semitism by anybody towards anybody. I just think that the dynamic of this is really, I mean, it serves no other purpose than actually undermining cohesion in the United States. And I'm one of the people, if you look at heat maps and again and everything else, there are a lot of unfortunate fingers that are involved in this. Okay, last point. You've got some breaking news before we part.
Yes. The Department of Justice has said that they are going to indict Congressman Henry Cuellar later today. Congressman Cuellar is a Democrat from Texas. He serves on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee and is the ranking Democrat on the Homeland Security Appropriations Committee. His home was raided, if you remember, back in 2022 as part of a federal investigation into Azerbaijan and a group of U.S. businessmen who have ties to the country. And now here we are about 2 years later, and they are going to indict him. Not sure if that's what it's connected to, but it probably is. And that is a seat that could go Republican if Cuellar is out.
It's fascinating how incredibly tight the race is. One of the things I wanted to say is just endorsing what the president had to say, right? You have a right to peaceful protest. You have a right to free speech. You can even say stupid stuff and you will get held accountable by society for it. But you don't damage property. You don't threaten people and you don't make them feel unwelcome. Kids are there to study. They're there to go through commencement. Some of these kids didn't go through their high school graduation. And so this is important. And so you really have to be at a level of incredible selfishness to do this to your fellow students and citizens. And, you know, and if you're the mayor of the District of Columbia and students are blocking a public street that a lot of people depend on, I don't even think it's contestable.
Well, let me just add one thing.
Go ahead, Dove. Last thought before we part. Go ahead.
Yeah, very quickly. Look, there have been some peaceful protests. I mean, after all, we're talking about many, many campuses. But the focus of the media, for obvious reasons, is on the protests that are not peaceful. Columbia, that's right, and UCLA in particular. And when people see that, they don't think about the peaceful protests. All they think about is the violence. And of course, this may well be a forecast of what might happen in Chicago, which, again, Chicago 68 really hurt the Democrats. So I would just underscore what Michael said, that because of the violence, which gets all the headlines, this could seriously hurt Democrats in November.
Which is why, if you look at the great protest leaders, whether it's Martin Luther King Jr. or whether it's Gandhi, it's the onus on us to always be peaceful and never be the one who escalates in this. And when you protest, you also have to pay the price of the protest, ultimately, if it's going to have any value, right? So ultimately, folks are really missing it. If it was quiet and respectful and did not have an anti-Semitic tone to it, because Arab students would point out, hey, we're Semites too, by the way, right? So anyway, everybody, thanks very much. Terrific discussion as always. Hope everybody has a great weekend, a great week. Look forward to having you guys back on again next week. And thanks so very much, Jim. Again, welcome back. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Please check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by our very own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with our own Laura Winter, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and that's sponsored by TE Connectivity, and the Air Power podcast that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler, that's sponsored by GE Aerospace. Thanks very much again. We'll be back again on Sunday with the Business Roundtable. Until then, hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much.